A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome to Going Off Track.
Hello.
I'm Jonah.
I'm Brad.
And together we are two guys sitting in Brad's living room in the middle of the day.
Sitting around watching the sunset.
Yeah, so we were watching the sunset.
It's that slow part of the season, man, when like...
It gets dark so early, huh?
You know, if there's anything good about being a parent, it's... I mean, because before I became a parent, I remember this time of year, you know, because I was like... DJing and playing in bands, and you would like, and I would get up at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon and not make it out of the house in time to catch any sunlight.
Wow.
And it was just so depressing.
That's like the real like rock and roll life though.
I don't know, man.
You know, it's weird. It's weird like that. It's weird how that goes from like being cool to just being like really pathetic. And there's like a fine line where like it just switches. I feel like
except,
it's the same.
You know, if given the choice, I like that. I mean, I like those hours. I don't know what it is. I can think clearly at night.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I don't miss, you know, I don't miss going on touring and, you know, like, and I don't definitely don't miss fucking DJing in New York clubs at all.
I hate DJing. I mean, I'll do it once in a while just to make money, but I really don't enjoy it. I don't enjoy staying out that late.
I don't enjoy going out like that late anymore.
Yeah.
But I did I've liked being awake at like 3 o'clock in the morning, even if it was in my own apartment. Just, I don't know what it is.
See,
my juices flow at that hour.
I think some people, I think it depends how you're wired. I mean, for me, I wake up around 7 every day pretty much and go to yoga. And I love like it being like, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. I've already done this, like all this like breathing, all this stretching. I feel like that really sets me up for my day. Like that feeling to me is better than like staying out for an extra couple hours at night.
You're probably on the right track.
Well, I mean, like, you know, not in like a judgmental way, but I feel like that there's almost, it's not a high, but there's like a sort of like mental kind of like, it just, I don't know. I feel like it just like makes things easier to deal with throughout the course of the day.
Well, physiologically, that's when humans are supposed, you're supposed to be active with the sun and not in my fucking preferred.
It's nice. I never thought I would like getting up early. The only thing that sucks is riding the L train in the morning. I mean, I'm so far out that I can always get on, but it's like by the time I get to Union Square, it's like,
sardines.
It's pretty intense. There's definitely been like a couple moments where I was like, I think there's gonna be a fight, especially like on like Bedford, like people just like jamming in,
right?
It's like, and it's like, yeah, it's pretty crazy because it's like if you live over there, like every train is just gonna be, you know, like that's one of the perks of just being kind of far out.
Yeah.
There aren't that many people on the train when I get on.
Right.
If the train's crowded when I get on, it's like things are really bad.
Ugh.
Eesh. But yeah, you're down here in the real Lower East Side, you can walk everywhere.
Pretty much.
Yeah, that's nice.
Sometimes I even take a bus, although that's pretty miserable.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's nice to be in Manhattan.
Yeah, I've actually been toying with the idea. I feel like Brooklyn is getting so expensive that I've been toying with the idea of moving back to Manhattan. I don't know really if it would cost that much more.
At this point, I don't know. I was just out in Bushwick yesterday.
Really?
I went to see Aaron. And
hit me up, man.
No, I should have.
I've actually been meaning to see Aaron too. Aaron.
Aaron Bastinelli.
Aaron Bastinelli.
There you go. If you want to mix your record, call Aaron.
Yeah, Aaron mixed the United Nations song, Stairway to Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah.
which features a vocalist that sounds a lot like Daryl Palumbo from Glassjaw.
Wow.
And speaking of which, Glassjaw just have a new record that came out, Material Control. And it's pretty funny. I actually interviewed them recently for Noisy. And do you know anything about this record?
No.
So their first record in 15 years.
Oh, wow.
The last record came out in 2002. So they made this record, and they put out a couple EPs, but they're like a very kind of like enigmatic band. And so the idea for the record, I talk about this in the piece, was their guitar player, Justin Beck, owns this merchandising company. So he compiled all these addresses of people that had ordered Glassjaw stuff. And the idea was he had these, there's 10 songs, and he made flexies with different art for each flexi that were almost like postcards, but you could play them. And he wanted to just mail them out to all these fans and not tell them it was coming. And that was how people would find out there was a new record after 15 years. And somehow there was some technical thing with the label, and they accidentally put a pre-order up on Amazon with like the title and the release date, like 2 weeks before it came out. And all of these blogs picked up on it. And so like, it kind of spoiled the surprise. And it's so funny because I interviewed him about it. I'm friends with his wife. Oh, we did an episode with him and his wife.
Yeah.
We did an episode with Justin and Melissa, and Justin was like, yeah, it's funny. My wife said it was perfect Glassjaw irony that we called the album Material Control, and the material was not controlled. But the record is awesome. So if you're a Glassjaw fan, check it out. You can check out that interview if you want. Daryl and Justin are great dudes. And yeah, it's great. They have a new record. So hopefully they'll be doing some more touring. But yeah, today on the podcast, another kind of, those guys are post-hardcore legends. I would say today's guest is more of a hardcore legend.
I would definitely say that. I mean, it was, you know, he's the founding father.
Yes. Today on the podcast, we have Craig Sitari, who I want to thank Paul Delaney from Kill Your Idols and Black Anvil and all these other bands for putting us in touch. But Craig, yeah. Bass player in Sick of It All. Maybe you've heard of him. He also played in Agnostic Front, The Cro-Mags, Straight Ahead, Youth of Today. Craig is just, it's funny how like Craig's like, yeah, I wasn't sure if I was like really part of the NY New York hardcore scene because I was from Queens. I was like, I don't know, dude, you're like about as New York hardcore as it gets.
If you look at New York music history, the most iconic people were from Queens.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yes, Craig.
Yes,
Craig. You're fully validated.
Craig, you're the real deal. And I want to also thank Craig. There were a lot of cheesy jokes I made about Sick of It All during this podcast, as I did with our episode. You can go back. We did an episode with Lou and Pete, which three was or four years
also,
ago.
Also awesome.
Which was also great. Those guys are great. And what I like about these guys is, yeah, they're so talented, so down to earth, and they have a very good sense of humor. And yeah, and there was a sign in the studio that said step down because there's a step, and it's like, that's the name of a song off Scratch the Surface. And I was with Steve Grawalski, and I was like, I gotta make this step down joke. And so I like tried to make it twice, and like other people were talking, then I was like, hey Craig, don't forget step down. And he was like, uh-huh. Like, he's a very good sport about it. Which I thought was cool. But yeah, if you're not familiar with Sick of It All, I mean, they're just celebrating their 30th anniversary. They just did a run of like super small shows. I think they played like Bowery Electric, Vitus, a show in Queens, and they're just, yeah, there's a reason why they're a legendary band. So it's like,
yeah, all and they still are fucking
yes.
Amazing
yes.
Live.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I was talking to Craig, I forgot in this podcast. I saw them in high school. They toured with AFI and Snapcase. Mm-hmm. And I remember it blew my mind. But yeah, I mean, I grew up listening to, yeah, Scratch the Surface, obviously. Blood, Sweat, No Tears, Built to Last. I mean, they have so, and then they have newer stuff, and then they re-recorded some of the old stuff, and they still tour a ton.
Yeah.
I just miss them in Asia, but they are just a monster live band. Everyone in that band so talented. And
Craig, of course, came to Pulse Music.
Yes. Yes.
Which sorry, we I'm gushing.
Yes. So, yeah, shout out to Pulse Music.
We've been doing all our podcasts at Pulse yes. lately. So, thanks to them for hosting and to Steven Grawalski for engineering. Fantastic job, as you will hear shortly.
Yes. So, yeah, enough of us rambling. Should I say anything about donating? Should we save that for the end? I'm going to say very briefly, we'll talk about the end, but where I'm. Patreon. So
patreon.com/goingofftrack if you want to become a member, and there's a lot of incentives and levels of contribution you can make, but just go check it out, and we'll talk about it more after this
podcast with Craig Sitari. Enjoy. It's going off track.
I love that shit because I've been a vegetarian for like 25 years now. And how many times like I've dealt with this like perception of like, you know, like you're almost like weaker, like not manly because I'm like not eating meat. Like,
yeah,
I've been
gorillas
dealing with
are
this
vegetarians.
Shit,
like, that's like the strongest animal there is,
yeah,
practically. You know
I've
what
been
mean?
Dealing with this like this whole time. So when I see like John Joseph out there like saying this shit on Instagram and I'm like, yo, no one's going to fuck with him. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you're not taking him down a peg like you're going to do me. Like,
are hippopotami vegetarian? They are, aren't they?
What's that?
Hippopotami.
I believe so. They? No, they're not.
No, they're not because they, yeah,
yeah,
right,
they
I'm wrong
up,
about
no,
that.
No,
yeah,
but I think they are.
They kill, but they
kill
don't eat
animals,
meat.
But they don't eat them.
Oh, really?
I could be
sure.
wrong, but I think you're right.
Yeah. I was wondering. I said
they do mess people
I could,
up.
I could look it up.
Hippopotami?
We'll just say
hippopotami. Yeah, that's I believe so.
See, I'm on air. I have to like be careful. Like, I don't mess up.
Nah, don't worry.
And my Queens accent will come through. There's no getting rid of that.
There's going to be a lot of. We do have a big zoologist crowd.
Really? Yeah. Okay, all right. That'll work.
We just tell lies. That's all we do. Make up facts.
Don't we all, my friend? Don't we all?
That's these days. That's how it goes, man.
So, Craig, you started playing bass when you were like 2 years old. Is
no,
that true?
No, about 10.
10?
10, yeah. Probably in, I guess around 1980. Probably around 1980, I started playing bass. I was in like fifth grade, I guess.
And how did that come to pass that young? That's not really...
My brother started going, he was in like ninth grade, he was going to high school, and he went to his, in his music class, Danny Lilker. You know who Danny Lilker is?
No.
He's the bass player for Nuclear Assault and Brutal Truth, and he was the original bass player for Anthrax.
Yeah.
He was in my brother's music class, and they became fast friends really quickly, and he would come over for lunch, you know, with my brother, and... Danny wanted my brother to play bass for Anthrax originally when they were just like, hey, we have this idea. We're going to do a cover band. We're going to cover like Motorhead, Priest, and Maiden. So it was like an idea for a cover band, you know, like that was like when first Maiden album was out or whatever. And he was teaching my brother bass, but I was picking it up more because I was more into it. My brother just wanted to like pick up girls and smoke joints. So it was more like my thing, and I was like super into it. So I was like, you know, how do you play this? How do you play that? And then I just started figuring out stuff on my own, you know?
And did I read that you played a show at CB's when you were 14?
Yeah, 14.
So I was like 84 and you were
14? Yeah, like 84. I was like 14, yeah.
I mean, like the thing I wonder in a situation like that is like...
14, 15. Yeah, 14, I think, yeah.
Like I used to have to go to like great lengths to go to shows at like the Pipeline or Studio One and places like that when I was, you know, in high school. Like I had to sneak around to go to places
Yeah.
Like what was the actual process of you at 14 getting your bass to CB's and like and playing a show? Like,
well, it was just a matter of I first started going to Danny Lilker. It all goes back to Danny Lilker, who was you know a big influence to me. And he would give me records, 7 inches, like tapes that he traded, you know what I mean? Turned me on to like new wave of British heavy metal stuff. And then from there, it went right to like The Exploited and Discharge and stuff like that. So I was into it, but I was really little. So I'd always be like, you know, I could take the subway and all that, but not really. I was kind of like too little unless I had somebody to go with me. So the first place I went was a Met game, and the second place was like CB's. I went with Danny to a show, and you know, he's like, hey, we got to go to a show. I was like, let's go to a show, but a lot of times I couldn't. So finally, we went to a show, and as soon as I went to my first show, I went every week, even if I had to go by myself. I would just take the train in, and right when I went to shows, the first show I went to, I walked in. I've told the story a million times, but Big Charlie Hankins, may he rest in peace. He was the bouncer at CB's.
Uh-huh.
He was a hardcore guy, and he was a giant black man that weighed about 265 pounds. And he played, the way I knew him was he played on the football team in high school, and he was friends with Danny Lilker and my brother, Scott. Sometimes it would just be Danny and my brother coming to lunch, but Big Charlie would come over a lot too because they were all friends. So I knew Big Charlie from coming at my house, and my mother would always make jokes about how she had to make three times as much food because he was so big and ate so much. So first time I went to CB's, Big Charlie was there.
Huh.
And he's like, hey, kid, what are you doing? And, you know, obviously Danny's I didn't tell you, you know, Charlie's going to be here, blah, blah, blah. And first thing Charlie did was grab me, and he grabbed everybody. It was like 50 people at the show. He goes, you see this guy? He's my friend. He's like, he's a good kid. And then everybody was my friend after that. And I went on his shoulders and I danced the whole show. It was like an AOD show, I think.
That's awesome. That's you had amazing. The pass. You never had to.
I had the pass right away.
You never had to do the shit.
So the first time I played CB's, I just, you know, went in, whatever. I probably got one of my friends that was a little older to drive me in. One of my brother, I think my brother's friend, either my brother or my brother's friend, Joe.
And you were coming from Queens or Long Island?
Filipino now, I thought. Okay. Queens. I grew up in Bayside, Queens.
Bayside.
So Danny lent me his amp. And I had a bass already, so I went and played, and that was the setup for the first show. And the first show I ever played, Stigma was there, and he sang all the words. Wow. And I was like, I was used to stage diving, so was Carl. You know, later on, Carl Iceman, okay. Carl Mosh, yeah, rest yeah. in peace. They were at the show dancing. All the old-timers, Billy Psycho, they were all singing along and dancing. And I was like, how do you guys know the material? And it turns out a bunch of them had the demo tape that we were selling at CB's before we played our first show. We had a demo, and we'd sell it like outside at CB's for like $3 or whatever.
Cool, man.
So it was pretty cool. That's like, that's wild. Best part about it was like, You're in high school and there's all these jocks and I was like a little weird kid and everyone's like not everyone's an asshole. I had friends, but it's like, you know, a typical story. But and then you go to CB's and they're the scariest people you ever saw in your life and they're all super cool.
Yeah.
You know, so it was a place where you were judged not by anything other than what you brought to the table. You know
it's funny too, because when I asked that question, I was expecting like the 14, I'm riding the bass in my Subway and I used to do that too.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
then I got... This, like, I was expecting, like...
I used to take my bass on the Subway in a cardboard box. I had a big cardboard box. I didn't have a case. I couldn't afford a case.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just the fact that my mother bought me a bass when I was little was great. First, I had my brother's bass, but then my mother bought me my red bass. She bought it for me as, like, a birthday present. So she bought me that, but I had no case, so I carried it in a cardboard box.
Back then, that might have been a good idea.
Yeah, take it on the train. You'd have to like hold it underneath and walk on the train with it.
Nobody's gonna.
No one knew it was.
Is that the bass?
No, the head would stick out. The head.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Is that the bass? I had a poster of you guys in my wall growing up. I think it was maybe
the red chopped
built
up
to
bass.
Last. Yeah, it had like all. It was kind of wood underneath.
Yeah.
Sitting I stared at that when I tried to fall asleep.
Oh wow!
Not in a creepy way.
That'll keep you awake. Right? Yeah. That'll keep you awake.
Did
That's
you
great
see
bass.
A lot of those early Anthrax shows through your brother?
Like when they I think I saw their first or second show. It was in like St. John's Church in Flushing, Queens. They did like all covers. You know, they did like an hour of covers. So I went to see that, and it was like they were like a cover band. You know, they did like old British new wave of British heavy metal and. Some rock songs as well. I remember going to see Danny Looker. I had this band called White Heat. This was like probably 1980, 80, 81. And I'd go see them play at like my father's place out on Long Island. And they would play like a local VFW hall. And they did like Van Halen and, you know, like Queen songs and Van, you know, like they did like metal and rock songs. And I was like a little kid. I was like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah.
Loved it, you know?
Was that your entry into music? Was
pretty
was
much yeah.
70s rock stuff?
Pretty much. When I was like 6 years old, my brother brought home the first Sabbath album and like in like 76, I think he brought it home. And him and his friend Lyman, who was he was like a real 70s troublemaker Lyman, you know, like old school troublemaking kid, you know. And what they did was they played it. They locked me in a room when I was like 5 or 6 years old, turned the lights off on a rainy day, played the song Black Sabbath. And I was like crying in the room and they let me out. And then a week later, I was like, you know, I was like, you guys are assholes. And a week later, I was like, I want to listen to it again. I want to listen to it again. And I was into Sabbath. You know what I mean?
That's awesome. They did like with a Sabbath album, like what my brother did to me with like Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
Like they thought it was that spooky.
But if you said The Exorcist, I still get that scared watching The Exorcist. That thing just gets you, man.
Yeah, that movie fucks me up.
Crazy.
Possession's weird.
Weird.
Possession, I don't know.
Taps into something deep like sharks, you know what I mean? Just scares you deep.
Creeps me out.
It does.
I wonder. Joni, you ever... dealt with
been possessed?
You ever been bit by a shark?
You ever been with a chick that seemed like she was possessed?
No, I don't think so.
Just ask him if he had an Italian girlfriend.
Well.
I don't think I have. I don't think I have.
No offense, Italy.
Jonah never kisses and tells. He doesn't tell us.
So I need clarification on something that's become like an all-time historical story and then also like tall tale. In a lot of ways.
It sounds like one that would be embellished.
Yeah, I think so. And it's funny you're wearing that hat because I think that's the place it happened.
Okay.
So do you know or were you there during the head in the bag story?
That wasn't Detroit. That happened in...
That wasn't Detroit.
Now, I thought it happened in Pittsburgh, okay. but just we were just talking about this the other day with this band. I forget who it was, but Lou and Pete were telling it to this guy, and I think it was somewhere in Ohio, but I could have sworn it was in Pittsburgh at the Electric okay. Banana. But what happened was, I wasn't there. This is before I played in Sick of It All. I was playing in AF at this time. It was in the 80s. They played a gig. Some dude comes running. There was woods across the street. That's why I thought it was the Electric Banana.
Oh,
in
Pittsburgh. Okay.
Woods across the street. Dude comes walking out of the woods with like a paper bag or something like that, and it's all wet. And the guy's yelling something or whatever, and he's saying how there's a head in the bag. And they're all like, yeah, show it to us if there's a head in the bag. That's bullshit, blah, blah, blah. And the guy pulls a human head out of the bag, puts it back in. Everybody runs. They get in their cars. They leave. And turns out, like, it was in the paper, like, a day or two later that some guy murdered somebody, cut their head off in the town where it happened. So it was, like, some, like, crazy dude, like, you know. And so, the dude was all boasted about it being, like, you know, aggressive, you know?
Yeah, like, look at my head in this bag.
Yeah. Like, wow. Well, they said he was kind of, like, out of his mind. Seemed like a crazy guy.
Nah. Yeah,
really?
Cut somebody's head off, you know?
Well, that's, like, too, I mean, you know, we loosely say, like, cut somebody's head off. But,
no,
like,
literally cut
think
some...
of, like, the physical process of taking a human head off.
Just ask OJ. It's got to be rough. You know what
no joke. It's no joke. Wait, he cut someone's head off?
Yeah, he cut his ex-wife's head off. That was like a soldier. Her head was hanging by like some skin and a little bit of like a little sinew.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't either.
Just a little sinew.
I think both of them, right? I think Ron Goldman, too.
I don't know if he cut Ron Goldman's head. He cut one of their heads basically off, and the other one, he like stabbed them so badly.
Yeah.
You know?
That's some nasty shit.
People say that his son did it, and there's like some weird conspiracy thing.
There's OJ's
conspiracy.
They say OJ's son did it, and OJ covered for him.
How old was his son then?
It's his older son from the first man.
Supposedly he was disturbed.
Why, just because he had smaller gloves?
Oof. This is bullshit.
The son?
What?
Listen, the glove thing is pretty obvious. It was wet outside. The leather got wet, and it shrunk. It's pretty.
Pretty
basic. And he like holds his hand wide open to try to put it on.
Yeah, you know. Listen, the guy.
It's hilarious.
Yeah. No.
The guy. You know. My take on it is the guy has a malformed frontal lobe, which is where your impulse control lies. So when he gets aggressive, he probably blacks out and just sort of lost his shit.
You think could be football related, like CTE kind of stuff?
I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, maybe. Who knows? You never know. I never thought of that. But I know dudes that have like rage issues. Mm. And if you know anything about that, it's all from a malformed frontal lobe. Mm. At least it's... That's the physical definition of it.
You can see it like on a CAT scan or something?
Yeah. There's all shows on it. I first got turned onto that by watching all these shows about it. And I was like, you know, saying things like, this guy must have a malformed frontal lobe because he's fucking crazy.
Is that something you're born with? Or is
stay away
that
from
develops?
That guy.
I think you're born with it. But it can happen from an injury as well. But you're kind of born from it.
Huh.
Born with it.
Wow.
Jesus.
It's like a strange thing.
So then it could be genetic too, maybe.
Very possibly. I mean, you black out, people that black out and go into blind rage. I don't really go into blind. I've gone into blind rages a few times in my life, but it's not something like that just happens when I get mad. It's very rare.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, like, I would think that in a person like myself that doesn't, I would assume, doesn't have a malformed frontal lobe, it's only going to happen to me when something really crazy happens where I have to really go off. You know what I mean? But some people, like, you know, they spill their coffee and they're ready to cut somebody's head off down to the sinew. You know what I mean?
What was sort of the New York music scene like, I guess, like in like the late 80s when you guys formed Sick of It All?
It was starting to grow. By the late 80s, it was already pretty popular. It was like Suburban Kids coming down. It was really popular. Early 80s, when I first went to shows, it was like clove, cigarette, punk rock, trench coat. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was like punks and skins. You know what I mean? Was like that. But by the late 80s, it had already expanded quite a bit. And a lot of Suburban Kids into it, myself being one of them. Well, you know, Queens, borough kid. And it grew a lot by the late 80s. It was cool. I mean, you know, the whole music, the whole hardcore scene in New York, to me, was just a great thing all the way through. There were some years where it got a little cloudy, but I was always drawn to it. You know what I mean?
Was that something like during that time... when it started to grow and kids started to come from out of town to shows, was like people inside the scene like resentful of the growth?
Or no, like not really. Not a little bit, in spots, but not really. You know, yeah. I mean, I was welcomed with open arms, and as long as you came in cool and humble, That was never a problem. I mean, certain kids in the night, a lot of kids that were around and came in 87, 88, there was like the whole beginning of the whole gangster rap influence in hardcore, where it became like a little bit violent. You had like a little bit of a gang mentality. Hip hop had like an influence. There was a positive hip hop influence, and there was a negative hip hop influence, you know? It was both sides of that coin were represented. So you got kids that would come in and right away they'd try to steal somebody's shirt, try to steal somebody's boots.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was like almost like an extension of the earlier skinhead thing. Huh. So you got some weird stuff that went on. But, you know, half the guys that came in and tried to do that wound up getting beat up the first time and then became friends with everybody. You know what I mean? Some of the guys like who are like known names from like the later generation like that.
Yeah.
Came in, got their ass, did something stupid, got their asses kicked. Came back, you know, a couple weeks later, and everybody was like, okay, cool, whatever. And
is there any of those no names you're allowed to say?
Yeah, Sob's first show. He I don't know if it was his first show, but Tommy Carroll, from, you know, my old band Straight Ahead, was dancing. And Sob and a bunch of other young kids at the time, like, jumped on him because he had long hair at the time. Tommy grew his hair out. So they jumped on him, and a couple guys tried to get him. So Tommy waited outside, and a bunch of guys came outside, and Tommy was going off, and he was, like, talking all this shit. And he's like, anyone wants to fight me, I'll fuck you all up, blah, 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 step up, blah, blah, blah. And they were all, like, scared. And Tommy went to walk away, and Sob goes, I'll fight. And Tommy just beats the shit out of him, like, ripped him, you know, stuck his fingers in his nose, dragged him up the street after he beat him down. Ooh. Beat him down bad, but Sob came back, rest his soul, Sob. Sob was my friend, God bless him. And, you know, he came back, and he was cool. You know, we joked about it for years after that. You know, we'd, like, Tommy would make jokes, they would make jokes to each other. It was, you know.
Just had to take your one.
It, you know, if he looked for it, and he got it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever, no big deal.
What's it like for you, like, obviously, like, you know, like, John Joseph, Harley, Roger, all these guys have written these memoirs. Like, do you read those? Is that like a trip down memory lane?
I read John's book. It was excellent. I'm in the process of reading Roger's book right now. When Roger was doing his book, he was talking to myself and Matty Henderson a lot about his story. So he was like, hey, read this story. Is this how it was? Do you remember? You know, like, hey, what do you think? Like, so Matty and I were like sort of chiming in on his stories to help him shape him a little bit memory-wise, you know what I mean?
Just to make sure, like, he was remembering it right. And...
yeah, I even wrote a couple things for him and sent them to him. They, you know, they got changed in editing, but it was just to, like, hey, this is what I remember.
Yeah,
you know what
yeah.
I mean? So he was trying to put his notes together when he was getting close to the end to make sure everything was kosher. So the little bit I've read of it so far, I think it's great. John's book was great. I never read Harley's book. But
when's the Craig Sitari memoir coming out?
You know what it is? Too many people are doing it. It's happening. So many people are doing it that I think it would be like I'm flooding the waters. But I would write a book. But my book would probably be a little different if I wrote a book. If I wrote a book, because I'd have I talk about my childhood a lot. My childhood is a lot of stories from my childhood that of why I got into this and all that. And I have a lot. I have a lot more tour stories than anybody else. Maybe not Roger, because Roger has a lot of my tour stories. A lot of my best tour stories are probably in Roger's book, so that kind of messes it up for me.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? A lot of my craziest stories will already be
in
Roger's.
Together.
Yeah, it's like, okay, I'm going to tell the story in Roger's book now, because it's, you know, the story of those days. But I think I would write a good book. I think it would be less tough. It would be less tough. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, I think
I'm not into the whole tough thing too much, even though...
Yeah.
I boxed for years and I can fight. I just don't like to talk about that too much. You know what I mean?
Sure.
What's tough all about? Rather have fun. You know?
Yeah.
That's what's up.
What? I was curious about Sick of It All. Obviously, that alleyway, the symbol is so iconic. I mean, how did that kind of come about?
That's actually Flash Tattoo, a tattoo Flash from, I think, Greg Irons. And we started using it a long time ago, and it actually became our property after a certain number of years of us using it.
Oh, okay.
It became ours, and we were able to file trademark on it, so we own it now.
Is that when... Did that happen during the whole thing with Mobb Deep?
Or no, it was before that. We owned it before that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, Mobb Deep wound up using it, too. It's a cool symbol. They liked it, you know?
Yeah.
And they weren't... Some of the people that we knew that worked at their label were hardcore people and explained it to them, so everything worked out all right, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that never, like, got to a weird point.
No,
right?
They used it a little bit. I think they might have used it once after that, but listen, it's not like, hey, you can't use that. It's our thing. We're known for it. They understood that, and they probably used it a little bit because it was there. They were also known with it to a degree, so...
Sure.
As long as they don't try to claim it indefinitely forever, since we technically own it, you know, it was all cool. We actually did a song with them.
Yeah.
On that Rockers Against Rappers. No. That was something else. That was a boxing thing. That's something else. Rockers Against Rappers was a boxing thing that Kevin Kelly, the former featherweight champion, was doing.
Really?
And he wanted me to fight Parrish from EPMD, who outweighed me by 40 pounds. It never happened. But I was an actual amateur boxer, you know what I mean? But a dude that outweighs you by 40 pounds, and he boxed a little bit too. So when a guy outweighs you by 40 pounds, it's pretty rough. And that dude's big. You ever see him?
No.
At the time, I weighed 147. I was a welterweight, so I was small. But anyway, we did that song with Mobb Deep. That was something else. I got the names confused.
Yeah, yeah.
Just little weird stories pop out of you.
What's more like nerve wracking for you, like playing like a huge festival show with Sick of It All, or like having to like fight someone?
Neither one's nerve wracking.
Really?
If you're boxing, if you're prepared, if you're really, really in shape, you're not worried about anything. There's nothing to worry about.
Really? You're not like, oh, I hope I don't get hurt really bad.
No. You're doing it every day. When I used to box, you're sparring 3 days a week. And if you're going to actually fight like in an exhibition or something like that, you're like fighting hard. You're going in with the strongest, fastest guys you can find to be the best you can be. So, you know, I would look at it like nobody's hitting me harder than nobody's beating the shit out of me the way my coach Ed would beat the shit out of me. Nobody's hitting me harder than this other friend of mine, Jay, would hit me. And then, you know, all these other guys. You know, at my weight, it's like I was going in with guys who were 100 times better than the level I would be fighting against. So it was no big deal. You were totally used to it.
Were you actually trying to take boxing past the amateur?
No. Boxing was something I always... My friends... I grew up in Queens and Bayside, and Sean Graham was my best friend growing up. And his uncle was Billy Graham, who was the welterweight from the 50s. They call him the uncrowned champ. He beat Kid Gavilan. He beat Sugar Ray Robinson in the amateurs. He was a top welterweight in the 1950s. So my friend Sean's father, Jack, was Billy's brother. He was a New York State deputy athletic commissioner. So when I was little, Sean, they would always do boxing stuff. And I was like, I don't care about that. I want to play music. And then at a certain age, when I got to be about 17 or whatever, 18, I went with him once to the fights, and I was hooked, and his father hooked me up with a trainer, and I got into that. And that was just a hobby. I always felt like it made me feel confident. It made me feel good. You know, I was always like a pretty shy, introverted kid up to the point where I got into boxing, and up to the point where I joined AF and got into boxing, I was very introverted.
Even though you were like already out playing shows and stuff.
Yeah, but I was very quiet and very shy. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like I was very non-confrontational. Then once I got to be in AF, I kind of learned they had like a rougher edge to me, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And the whole boxing thing, I was able to learn how to use my hands very well. I actually was really good with boxing at a certain point. And that's all I did. When I was off tour, all I did was box. I was young, so I was fit. I would come home. I would run till I puked. I'd go to the gym, work out for a week, and then spar anybody. You know what I mean? I'd box this guy, that guy, that guy. The Golden Gloves would come up. I'd box everybody. But I was never really competing because I was always on tour.
Right.
So outside of like fighting in the gym, you know what I mean? I'd fight in different gyms. I'd go to some different gyms and you know, there'd be some exhibition type stuff. But it's, you know, always
none of your dudes would fuck with you on the road?
No. These are your friends.
No, not in a real way, but you both glove up a little and mess around.
No, never. No, never.
Who in Sick of It All?
That's
do you
a boxing
think
is its own thing.
Could
it's a
actually
separate thing.
Stay in a ring the longest with you. Like, if you had the glove, like...
I don't know, man. That's a crazy question.
Who would hold up the longest?
Listen. Let me explain something to you. I am not in shape. Look at my gut. I had a bunch of knee surgeries. I can't even run anymore. When I was young, I was into it. Now, I still do it to stay in shape, but it doesn't really... it doesn't apply. Okay. Pete's a jiu-jitsu guy, and he's very, very fit.
Yeah.
Dude, he'll still be bouncing around while I'm like totally out of breath. The guy's fit as a fiddle.
We talked about his workout routine a lot.
Yeah, he's fit as a fiddle. Yeah. He's into it.
Yeah, definitely.
What do you think about like the crossover kind of happening now, like the McGregor Mayweather thing?
You know, that was cool.
Yeah,
give it a shot. I mean, I knew Mayweather was going to kill him. You know what I mean? Yeah, I think Mayweather carried him to the 10th, and sure the did. Reason he did. You know, this is what tells me that he says. Right after the fight, he goes, yeah, I tried to put $400,000 on myself to win in 9.5 rounds. Why would he ever say that? And he goes, oh, the casino said I couldn't. It was illegal. He knows that. Why would he say that? The reason he said that is it's a cover because he had one of his boys go and probably bet like $4 million or something to stop him in 9.5 rounds. He picked the later rounds because he knew by the 10th he'd be able to stop him no matter what. because, you know, yeah. even, okay, let's say the guy's tricky. He runs away. Let's say the guy, you know, holds a lot, right. whatever. By the 10th, he
by
knows
10,
he, by 10, he knows he can the, stop him.
Yeah.
No matter what the guy does, if the guy runs or does whatever. So he put money on it and he's like, all right, if you notice in the first couple of rounds, I got to say the other guy, you know, did better than I thought he would.
Yeah. Same.
But, Mayweather, he kept slipping to his left.
What was that theater?
He kept
I was
slipping
seeing?
To his left, and the Irish guy had his left his right hand out far. So Mayweather's dipping to his left. He could have cranked that left hook and knocked him out way earlier than he did. But you saw him hesitate. He wasn't pulling the trigger on it. And I was thinking he doesn't want to stop him.
Right.
He's just touching him up. Right. So I think he probably could have stopped him in six, 5 to 7. You know, the first three, though, I got to say, the first two or three, the Irish guy was, like, awkward. When somebody's awkward, you can look really bad in there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
His stance was awkward.
Yeah. You know,
it was real weird.
Keeps his hands
kept
out far.
Kept doing that rabbit punches.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's yeah. MMA stuff. Punches. But he keeps his hands out far because of the distance of kicking when they kickbox. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's a different thing. It's you know, and it's, it makes it awkward. You know what I mean?
Maybe you could illuminate this for me. So Floyd Mayweather is like in this room, right? He's in front of us. He's all gloved up. He's got this. And I let him hit me once. am I on my feet?
Where in your face?
What do I
depends
look like by the
hit.
End of that?
Have you ever played Mike Tyson's
depends
punch
how,
out?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's you.
Huh? What are we talking about? Is he taking two steps and hitting you on the chin
yeah,
from the
like,
ground up? And then
yeah,
you're
I guess he's like allowed to do whatever he wants. Yeah, like
well, if you're gonna like tie yourself to a telephone pole, you're gonna be out cold. But if he just like puts his hands up and you put your hands up and he throws one punch,
I might get out of that.
Yeah,
but
he's not like a massive puncher. He's just real sharp.
But just stick the face out and like
yeah, you're done. Doesn't take a lot.
Yeah,
it doesn't take a lot to take somebody out. Especially if you don't see it coming. The only times I ever got hurt really bad were when I got hit with a shot I didn't see.
Mm.
I've been hit by crazy heavy punches. Boom, boom, boom. I'll go rounds with them and, you know, you feel them, but you're all right. But when you get hit, you can get hit with a punch that's not even that hard. If you don't see it, it hurts you.
I feel like, yeah, when you see a boxer get like an uppercut to the chin that
you don't
they didn't
see uppercuts,
coming,
that hurts you. Well, and even if it's not hard, if you get hit in the right way, when
right
you don't
way.
See it, it hurts you. If you see it coming, it's not that bad.
Have you ever gotten like injured on stage with people like stage diving or
hells
like,
yeah.
Yeah.
1,000 times. The Cro-Mags, we played a show in, it was a festival in Belgium, I think.
Groz Rock maybe?
Yeah, I think it was Groz Rock a few years ago. And, you know, I do that thing where I step with my left foot on the monitor and I kind of kick my leg up. We make jokes. I call it the Sebastian Bach. It's like a little joke thing that we do. I started just doing that. At one point, I was my back was hurting, so I was doing that to be active on stage. And
funny.
He was laughing. He's like, you look like Sebastian Bach doing that. I was like, it's like the Sebastian Bach kick. I was like, yeah, all right.
That's
so
all right.
So I step on the monitor, and I kind of throw the bass in the air. You know, I kind of hit a chord and throw my right side up in the air, and it kind of, you know, whatever. So I kind of did that at a Cro-Mag show, and this kid runs up behind me, and as I'm coming off the monitor, which is angled, as you know, the kid's behind me, so I can't step on the ground. So the timing of me stepping on the ground wasn't there because the kid was like running hunched over, and I wound up coming down on the side of my foot and basically like tearing all the tendons from my foot up my shin, you know, on the outside like that. Basically like my big toe kind of touched the inside of my shin pretty much. And I got pictures of it. It's crazy. It looks like my foot swallowed a purple tennis ball.
So did you just drop on stage mid-song?
I wasn't able to really stand because the angle I came down on. I hit the ground. I rolled. I sat there for a second and pushed myself up. And I couldn't walk, so I just kind of stood there on one leg and finished the show. It was like four songs left. I finished playing, then I went to the hospital.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah. What are you going to do? Yeah, but you're all adrenaline now. You don't really,
you know,
I knew something was wrong, but it would hurt, but it wasn't like, you're excited. You know what I mean?
Yeah, adrenaline counts for a lot. Man.
A lot.
This makes me proud. Like half my family's from Queens, so when you tell tough stories,
tough,
I'm like, ah, I'm like, that's
not
right.
Tough.
That's
it's just
up.
You know,
that's what's up,
dude. It's like
dude,
your turn.
One guy from Kings of Leon walked off stage when a bird shit on his head. you ripped your fucking leg apart and you stayed up for
dude,
four songs.
You're
good.
You're a musician, so you understand when you're into something.
Yeah.
When you're into performing and hardcore music is physical, it's like strong music.
Yeah.
You get psyched up. Like boxing,
I have one,
you get psyched up. It's strong. Yeah. It's hard. You got to, you know, you're kind of like so in the moment. You don't really feel anything bad. There I am cutting you off. See that?
No. You're right, though. I played a show once, my own tough story, where I had a cut on my arm that required 5 stitches.
Ooh.
That I played through the show and went to the hospital afterwards.
Did you?
Wow. But I got it in a way dumber way. I was going under a bus to get my baseball gloves to play catch with Chuck Reagan.
Oh, wow. Chuck's great. I love Chuck.
Just have a little soft toss, you know, with Chuck, with Uncle Chuck. And yeah, and I open the hatch and my elbow hits fucking apparatus on the bus bump.
That sucks.
And wound up with 6 stitches.
I used to bring mitts, you know, gloves and mitts on tour. And I would do the pads, you know, focus pads. I would do the pads with Chuck when we toured with him back in the
Cool.
Whatever year that was.
90s, that's a person.
I saw him on Saturday. Hot water.
Hits like a train. He's strong.
Oh, he just turns into a wolf.
Very, very strong. Very strong.
It's not even. It's animal like.
Yeah, he's very strong. We call him the general because of like the stars on his shoulders.
He one time, and he's got this like moral authority that you can't fuck with. So like
that voice too.
Yeah, it's just like it's like your dad is just yelling at you. Kind of, Chuck's yelling at. One time we were touring with Chuck, and someone snuck onto our bus and jumped into my bunk, like just a rando. And, you know, a couple people.
And like, you were in the bunk?
I wasn't
like
in
a,
there.
Like a music fan or like a homeless dude?
No, like a music, like a drunk dude at the show.
Okay.
Who thought it would be funny in his stupid drunk brain. And he kind of like just runs on the bus, like jumps in a bunk thinking it would be funny. A bunch of people start losing their shit, runs right out. And starts running down the street. My guys are all like, motherfucker, get
that's
the fuck
a, that's
out
a big
of here.
Violation.
All of a sudden, Chuck, just out of nowhere, is like, what happened? Just starts hauling ass after him.
Oh, wow.
The guy's already well gone. And, I, you know, I thought this was going to end. And literally, Chuck didn't beat him up. He just, like, talked.
Explained
like, he
it
just
to him.
Shamed him. Yeah. He, like, he stopped him in the street and was just like, this he is the reason him. Why you're horrible and you should never do this again. It wasn't physical. It was impressive. But he's so menacing in those ways that, like... And I'm sitting there, my OCD is going fucking nuts, knowing some rando was just in my bunk. I feel like,
to wash those sheets.
Desanitized the
whole
thing.
That really
disgusting.
Sucks.
Craig,
disgusting.
What's it like?
I had a story about
No, go ahead.
Yeah, tell
one
us.
One time, it was late at night, and we were playing some festival, and this drunk Scottish guy came up to our bus, like, hey, Scottish. He had his shirt off. The guy was gigantic.
Okay.
The guy was probably 25 years old, built like a tank, 6'4", 200 plus. He's like, hey, Scottish, let me get a beer. Let me do that. And the driver's like, no, get the fuck out of here. The driver's cursing at him. So the guy wants to fight the driver, and the guy's like coming on the bus. So I was the only guy on the bus.
Oh, no.
So I'm like, hey, hey. And the guy looks at me. I go, what are you doing, man? I go, this is my house. I just talked to him calm because the guy was a monster. I was like, I was like half asleep sitting there. Like, I was like, oh, God, I don't want to deal with it. Everyone else was out seeing some band play. It was like 2 a.m. I was like, this is the worst idea ever. So I talked to the guy for like 30 seconds, and the guy was cool. You know, he looked, all right, mate. All right, mate. I was like, yeah, okay. It's my house. I go, it's cool. I go, I'll give you a beer. Yeah. Just ask. I gave him a beer out of the refrigerator. I was like, it's cool. You know, and the guy left. I was like, whew. Wow, that could have been rough.
Don't swear to Scott.
You got to watch. I mean, the guy was hyped up, too. He was like big, big freckly dude with no shirt on, like all belt up. I was like, oh, this is
you
not,
must got Mel Gibson.
Not good.
Yeah, that
you don't
want to
mess with the Scottish, man.
I'll crush you like a wallop.
Plus, you can't understand a word they say.
It's terrible.
Rough. It's like another language.
I think bars in Edinburgh, you're not, there's no swear. If you swear, they'll kick you out because it leads to fights.
And Craig, I've heard from an inside source that you are a classic tour water hoarder, that you believe in hydration, and everywhere you go, you take an excess Absolute amount truth. Of waters and hide them in your bunk. Is this real?
I do. I've calmed down over the years, but here's what I do. I make sure, because there's nothing worse than not having enough water. Armand always makes fun of the way I say water. He says I say water. So I always go, water. So water. I say, trying to say water.
Oh,
but I always make sure the four corners of my bunk have the largest possible bottles of water in them. And I'll sometimes line
even
the whole foot.
Even
and
your
I'll,
head, your head corners?
I want one on each of the four corners, and I'll try to line the bottom where my feet are with bottles.
Have you ever played baseball?
You gotta have 2 liters. 3 liters. 2.5 liter bottles as a minimum every day on standby.
Yeah. Have you ever played bass?
Standby.
You ever played bass for H2O?
Never.
Because it sounds like it would fit great with your whole water.
Never did.
Oh,
I'm surprised that you. Let's go through. Like
I think I did the first time they ever did a song live. It was just Toby as a Sick of It All roadie, And I might have played bass, and he came up and did a song like at a show when we had no opening band. So I might have played bass for him once at their first.
Well, you've played in
kind of show
in so many bands. I mean, can you really keep track even?
I pretty much know most of. I pretty much know all the bands I was in.
Yeah,
yeah.
You want to list them so that we don't have to write them in the notes, show notes?
Hardcore bands that like in the hardcore scene. I'll tell you all of those. Band called NYC Mayhem. That later was Straight Ahead, Youth of Today, Agnostic Front, Rest in Pieces, Sick of It All, Creep Division, and this new version of the Cro-Mags.
Wait, who was Creep Division?
It was a band I sang for.
Mm-hmm. Who else was in that band?
It was
anybody from that
two
scene?
Of the guys from Good Riddance, myself, and a guy named Joe Fish, who was in a band called Redfish. Yeah. So when Sick of It All and Good Riddance toured together in Australia, there was no opening band for one of the shows. So Chuck and I, Chuck Platt, mm-hmm. he was like, you know, let's do a band for the show tonight. So we wrote like three or four songs in the dressing in the hotel room. And Russ, you know, the singer for Good Riddance, was like, I want to be the faceless bass player.
Nice.
And we were like, all right, you can be the faceless, like, early punk bass player. And then I forget who played drums. I think this guy Trevor played drums, who used to help with Sick of It All management. And we played a couple shows. We did covers and stuff like that. And then we wore stockings on our face because we had to
Trevor both. From Nasty?
Yeah. we had to both play. Afterwards, we wore stockings on our face, so like even people knew it was a joke.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, we were like, you know, we came back, and Chuck and myself and Russ were like, let's make a real band. So we have a full length that came out in 2001, and then we did an EP in like 2004.
Okay,
it's good stuff. It's a little more punk, you know. It's kind of like VFW style punk, a little Ramones meets, you know.
Nice.
I feel like even at some point in Sick of It All's career, it started to take on a little bit more of like a melodic. Not, I don't want to say punk because it's not necessarily what it was,
kind
but
of.
Like just it got a little more punk rock and a little more melodic. Like,
yeah, but after you do a couple of albums, how are you going to not make it all sound exactly the same? You got we drew from our Oi influences. You know what I mean? You draw from Oi influences. You draw from some new wave of British heavy metal influences. You know what I mean?
Sure.
You draw from different things. Old punk bands, nothing better than an old punk sing-along. You know, and in New York, it was always the pile-up. So that those types of sounds in punk rock were there. They just kind of got lost when everyone was trying to out-hard each other.
That's true.
You know what I mean? So we tried to put some of that back, real chant-alongs and stuff like that.
That's right. I feel like Jersey was good. I'll put a little credit on her name. We put the melodic back into hardcore.
Yeah, but we were always into that. I was never anti-melody or anything like that. I mean, melody has its place, you know what I mean? And people were like, what do you mean? When things became more metal and it became like this real, like, chugga-chugga, rough sound, everything trying to be harder than everything else, and then we kind of flipped the script a little bit, people were like, oh, well, what is that? That's not blah, blah, blah. It was newer kids that didn't really know the history of punk rock that were shocked by that because they didn't really know, you know, like old Oi bands and you know. They didn't know any of that stuff, you know what I mean?
And you guys lived it through.
Yeah, we were into that. That was like some of our roots, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Do you still have a lot of your old records and stuff?
Probably. I don't really have a turntable, but I have a bunch of stuff in my mother's attic, like tons of boxes that are probably completely warped. I have like dozens of unopened, like straight ahead records and stuff like that. And I have like, you know, Pay to Come 7-inch.
You got fucking eBay gold up there.
But I was never like a collector, so I have the records I liked. I didn't just constantly, you know.
When
I was in Youth of Today, those dudes were like serious record collectors. I was like, well, I'm not really. I listened to them. They were like really seriously into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We did a podcast with Ray about yoga and stuff. It was really cool.
He's serious with yoga.
Yeah.
He was always like super, super flexible.
Yeah.
The dude could
even then?
Even then, but now, you know, he's like a yoga instructor for yoga instructors.
Right.
Yeah.
He's
like serious.
He's like serious.
The last time I saw Shelter, he was just ripping it right on stage.
Dude's like really flexible.
Yeah.
He looks like he can float
real high.
Yeah.
I love that shit. What do you think, though, about like the modern? One of my two big issues I have with modern hardcore are, one, the need to put some kind of like melodic sing along into every chorus, like every single chorus, like, and the people who write breakdowns without fast parts. Like, do you?
You're talking about like pure stomp.
Yeah, like
chugga, those, like rung, dun, 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 all E bar chord, and then you talk about the other bands that do that for the breakdown, and then have the melodic chorus every time,
right?
And yeah. It's like not even like a cool melodic chorus; it's like the same cookie cutter melodic chorus
with like the white guy singing voice thing, like
yeah, that's like
that thing.
That's like the not so new thing, I guess. You know what I mean? Some of those bands are okay though.
The millennial howl.
I was just listening to Hatebreed the other day, and I'm like, you know what?
But Hatebreed,
this is how it's done.
Yes, that's how it's
done. This is how it's done.
If you want to play like real smash your brains in shit, like metal, smash your brains in with the hardcore edge, that's the band that does.
Because you go fast part to two-step to fast part to two-step, then the breakdown.
How are
you going to get a wall of death going? How are you going to do any of this
without
these setups? Right?
Yeah,
Jonah.
Yeah, absolutely.
You must agree.
And they have a nice swing to them.
Yeah,
they have a good swing. Drums are very good.
I can't listen to Hatebreed without just like kind of losing my shit a little bit. Even if I'm in like my car,
I actually can't listen to Hatebreed. I can see them live, but I can't listen to them.
No.
No, I'm not going to put on a Hatebreed record, but I'll see them live. I'll see them live and be, dude, I play so many shows with all these bands many years. You think I want to go home and listen to stuff that's going
to
break
my head?
What
are you listening to when you go home? It's just you hanging out.
I listen to R&B.
Yeah.
Like old Motown stuff. And I play along the bass to that stuff because I love that stuff.
Oh, wow.
Nice scales. I can't play all. You know,
some good fucking bass players.
Jameson's
the best. But some of those lines, like you listen to some of those lines, you don't even know what they are. And then when you figure them out, you're like, he's doing all that. He's doing, like, I'll give you an example. Like like Stevie Wonder, I Was Made to Love Her. The bass line in that is so busy. Meanwhile, the song is just kind of rolling along. Like, if you didn't think about it, and then you figure out that bass line, you're like, there's almost like no time to get the notes in.
That. Yeah.
Was that Stevie playing on that? Because I know he played
I don't know
a
who played bass.
Bass
on that.
He played everything on a few records.
Now those guys.
I don't know who played bass. Was that Jameson on that
cut?
It might have been. But it's badass. It's something like that. Like, and sometimes the bass will be so mellow and so back, and other times it'll push so hard. It's crazy.
Yeah, no, that's the best example of.
We just had to do covers of Four Tops.
Oh, I love the Four Tops.
Oh, yeah.
What's like, I'll Be There.
Oh, really?
Dude. Beautiful. That bass line is insane.
Yeah.
Dude, it's crazy.
And insane. To get the feel of it.
Yeah, the feel is what it is, man. You can't do it.
It's all about the drummer. Mackie plays all that stuff like perfectly. That's his like original style.
Really?
He plays that.
Like, see
that shit's so cool.
Like, he plays that at like a high professional level. He kills it with that.
Really?
Kills it.
Doesn't surprise me.
He just, whenever I'm like, yo, let's play this, he's like, yeah, whatever. You can't play that. He's totally just, I guess at the level he's played it at with the cats he's played it with, he's right. I'm just saying, like, you know, give me a shot. Come
let's
on.
Get it. Let's go. There
you go. Do you find that, like, you know, because of Sick With All having.
Oh, I listen to I listen to some old punk and old early hardcore. Like, I'll listen to, like, United Blood 7 Inch and, like, you know, like stuff like that. You know what I mean? I'll listen to, like, old punk and old hardcore sometimes, too, because that gets me psyched.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, if I'm, like, in my car driving, I listen to that, I'm like, fuck yeah.
Brings
great.
You back?
Yeah, it gets me psyched. You know what I mean?
That's awesome.
And I'll listen to some, like, I'll listen to Motorhead. I like old heavy metal. Aerosmith, I love. Sabbath, never. I never get tired of Sabbath. I can listen to Sabbath all day.
Just trapped in that room.
Dio Sabbath?
It's not even. Dio Sabbath is great, too. Yeah. Dio's great, man. But, you know, old Sabbath, but yeah, Dio Sabbath is great. But when I listen to that stuff, it's usually when I'm driving. When I'm home, I don't listen to as much music. When I'm home, I chill out. When I'm driving, I'll listen to music. When I'm doing stuff or if I'm working out, I'll listen to music. You know what I mean?
What I was gonna ask before is, like, do you think with like Sick With All having such a long and steady career at this point, like, does it take like an intentional ignoring of trends at that point, like, where, you know, would it have hurt Sick of It All, like, through these years to be super focused on, like, what's going on and what's cool and what people you want know, and the idea? Like, do you have to intentionally ignore that? Like,
not really, but the way we write and play is very specific to the way we sound. Like, we could play any song and it'll sound like guys throwing garbage cans downstairs. Right. We have, like, a very, like, heavy-handed way of playing, you know what I mean?
Sure.
You know, Armand is a very heavy-handed drummer.
Sure.
He's not very slick or smooth, but he's very...
fucking machine.
Yeah, he's a hard-hitting... Yeah. You know, it's like girders for a building to be, you know, erected on. You know what
sure.
I mean?
Yeah.
So it has a specific sound when he plays, you know? We just, like, and when I play with him, I lock in with him. So I play a certain way. I can play different ways, but with him, it comes out sounding a certain way.
Sure.
It's all about me trying to play as powerfully as possible. You
right.
know what I mean? So mm-hmm. It just comes out that way. You know what I mean? Lou singing, it's going to sound a certain way. Pete playing guitar. Pete plays that, like, kind of sloppy, ripping guitar. You know what I mean? It's a certain sound. We can't get away from that. So we could be playing a love song and it'll sound like us. You understand
right.
what I mean? So
yeah,
it's not as intentional as you think. You know what I mean?
Right.
To steer away from that. But if you, over the years, we have kind of, I'd say, gone with the trends a little bit, like, not you don't notice it, but I notice it. There are certain parts in songs where I'll write a part. But this sounds like this,
right?
That, you know, I'll hear something on the radio, and I'll be influenced by a song I hear on the radio, and there'll be a part in a song that's like that,
right?
But you don't hear it like that, but I know it's that. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Sure,
it's
sure.
like a riff or whatever. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
There is stuff like that.
That's cool.
I also feel like production value wise,
yeah,
that stuff just naturally changes record
yeah.
to record. You know,
the way I look at production though is like. All right, at first everything sounds like shit, but you look back and it's great.
Yeah.
You know, early punk stuff sounds great, but you think it sounds like shit, and then you become professional, quote. Yeah, I'm
right.
doing little quotes. You sound like, you know, Normandy Sound, for example, like where that place in Rhode Island where the records were done, where Leeway did
oh,
their
yeah.
record.
Uh-huh.
That was where it was like, oh, let's sound like professional now.
Right.
You know what I mean? So you go through that little phase, and you're like, oh, this sounds stale.
Yeah.
So you become like, you know, and then it's like, hey, let's write stuff that's really stripped down. Like Call to Arms, that record that we did.
Uh-huh.
It's like stripped down. You know what I mean? It's
yeah.
like, my idea was like plug in and play. Just, you know, and write songs that are just simple and just let it rip. You know,
mm-hmm.
just don't even try to make it anything. Just go. So it like, and then you're like, oh, well, we did that. Let's try this. Then we did that record with Steve Evitz, that Yours Truly record. And it sounds really, the production's nice on that. It's
yeah,
really clean.
Slick.
Which is like weird. And then it's like, all right, let's do this, let's do that. And then we like did a bunch of records with our producer we use now, Tua Madsen, and doing stuff with him, you know, it's we were like, wow, this guy really knows what we're supposed to sound like.
Yeah.
But then after a while he tries to and we try to go further with that and then we get away from ourselves. The kick drum's too boo boo too boomy and you know, it sounds too like metal produced or what, or too raw metal produced.
Right, right.
So then it's like, let's pull it back, you know? So it changes all the time. You know what I mean? It's like, you're trying to switch it up a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Last couple of records, I've been telling them like, make the bass sound like a warm SVT with growl. Don't do too much with it. You know, the drums need to sound more natural. Don't make them sound like they're anything but wooden drums loud in the room.
Sure.
It's almost like go back to basics. You know what I mean?
I feel like, I'm sure, Steven, you could jump on this a little with, like, I feel like recording has gotten to that point where it's starting to reel back naturally, where, like, people realize they've potentially gone too far
yeah,
with the things they were using and that things need to get scaled back a little bit. Like, I feel like a balance is starting to get found a little bit.
In my experience, it always comes in waves.
Yeah.
Where it's like people go with, like, what's the newest thing? And then it's like, no. It is just, what does it sound like in a room?
Yeah, pretty much.
But you see, what happens is that these tricks, these production tricks get layered on these fucking bands that don't have an Armand or a Ewan in,
yeah.
you know? And so
that,
then
that becomes
these
the
records
sound.
Come out and people go, wow, this sounds really good. And then they go see the band and the band fucking sucks.
And yeah, and
like,
you go,
we should get that guy to do our record because we yeah. fucking sound good. And imagine what we'll sound like. And what happens is you end up sounding the same.
Yeah. Sure.
You know what I mean?
Shit.
And you go, you're a pro tool.
Well, also, you're able to recreate those sounds live now. Yeah, like, you haven't even used to not one. Be able to.
Couldn't fake
you
know? It.
One of your little slick lines. You haven't
yeah,
even
yeah. I know. Well, Joe, I can't scratch the surface. I had an incredible step down joke already.
That was good. That was good.
That was
I was coming out of the door, and he goes, "Hey, watch out!" And he points to a sign that says "Step down."
That was pretty good.
I know.
He's like beaming now.
I got a film. I was really proud. I was really proud to share that with you.
He's from Ohio. He's all excited.
I mean, speaking of from Ohio, I mean, what's it like for you, like, when you walk around, like, the East Village or Lower East Side now, how does that feel? I mean,
it's very different, you know, yeah. It was raw. I mean, I grew up in Queens, so I'm a Queens guy, but, yeah, it's very different now, you know, it's, like, very touristy, very, you know, it's not gritty.
No.
It was gritty, you know? But, you know, guys like John and Roger will tell you more about that than me.
Well, yeah. Luckily, they're all Mets fans, all the new ones.
Mets fans?
Yeah.
Yeah?
That's what they do, right?
Listen,
they don't want to go all the way uptown.
Listen, I grew up in Queens. Listen, I was a lifelong Mets fan. But the Mets fucking suck.
You know,
it's like liking the fighter that quits. You know what I mean? It's like, how do you really like the guy if he doesn't have heart? You know what I mean? But I'm trapped. Tough. I'm a Mets fan by birth. I can't help it.
Yeah, you can't help
it. I live in Queens, but it's like not a real legit. I live in Ridgewood, but it's
Ridgewood's Queens.
Ridgewood's Queens, but I'm like on the border of Bushwick, and now they're calling it Ridgewick. I don't know if you heard about this.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. You're like, I know you're talking about.
And I don't say Ridgewick because it's like makes me
I go
feel
over
like
to Bushwick
dick.
A lot. I train with Gavin. You know Gavin from Burn?
Oh, yeah.
I train with Gavin. He owns a martial arts and fitness gym, and we're friends, old friends. So we box together a couple times. As a matter of fact, I'm supposed to go see him tomorrow morning. I have to text him and say, yo, I'll be there at 10 a.m. But we train together a lot, and he's on the Bushwick side of the Ridgewick thing.
Yeah. Right. how did you sort of, can you talk a little bit about like ATVs and sort of like how,
yeah, you came in.
Yeah. I mean, like, cause I think people will find that really interesting. Like, you're a kid from Queens and now.
All right. So
your favorite it's like thing the, to do when you
it's like the fresh air fund, you know,
yeah.
when I was 25, I grew up, it was my mother and my brother. We grew up, it was a small family. It was myself, my mother, and my brother in Queens. Had an alcoholic father that beat my mother, the whole thing. Boom. He was gone when I was young. He had a family with another woman that are my family as well, my brothers and sisters.
Okay.
So I didn't meet them till I was 25. So wow. At the age of 25, I came home from the tour in the 90s. And my brother was like, hey, I met like our brother John. He's cool. Huh. We got a sister Roxanne and a sister Rosie. They're
Where
cool.
Where are they at?
They're all over the joint. I'm getting to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
My brother's like, yo, they're really cool. You got to meet them. So I came home and I met everybody, and they had like a thing at my brother's house. It was like the whole family came, like the nephews and the nieces. It was like I met like 40 people that were like my relatives that I didn't know. And it turns out that like they're like, you know, they're family, obviously. Yeah. But like it developed into like it wasn't just like, oh, yeah, my half brother's over there.
Yeah,
it's my brother. It's my sister.
Proper
you know
family.
What I mean?
Yeah,
proper
sure.
family. So I have this whole huge family now that I never had, and I got it at 25. So my sister... her husband, Charlie. And the funny thing about Charlie is when I was a little kid, I used to go to this like auto parts store. I had like a little mini bike and I'd go in there like, hey, mister, how do I get this part for my mini bike? And it was an auto parts store. They didn't have mini bike parts, but he was cool. He would be like, listen, you got to go to Hillside Honda. You got to get like the little 50, you know, blah, blah, blah. You got to get like this gasket or whatever. You know what I mean? So he would hook me up and it turns out that's my sister's wow. husband.
Small world.
He was family.
He was family. So I'm like, whoa. So, my sister and Charlie bought a farm upstate. So I started going up there and I was like, this is great. And I had to ride ATVs and like, you know, shoot guns and stuff.
Is it a working
like
farm or is it?
Yeah, it's a working farm.
Wow.
They don't farm it. They lease to a farmer.
Right.
Which is what I do because I'm never home. But so I was like, yeah, I want to buy a place. So eventually I looked for a bunch of years and I wound up buying a place that connects to my sister owns the original place she had. Then they bought another farmer for an old farmer who was old and passing away. So they bought it from him and took care of him the last few years of his life. So I bought the piece that was connected to that, like a farm that was on the back end of all that. So all of our farms are connected. It's like over 400 acres.
Holy shit.
Yeah, so it's like crazy between the three of us. We have, you know, I got 30 acres. My sister has like, you know, 375 between our two farms.
Yo, I've been wondering where to go when the big wave comes. You gotta hook me up.
It's awesome. So what I do is, you know, my mother loves it. Like when I bought the place, my mother was crying because she grew up in Germany and like Bavaria. So to her, it was like, oh, it's like my childhood. She loves being out in the nature. So do I. That's what I loved more than anything. You know, so what I do when I'm on tour, all I can think about is going upstate, like you're saying, and like getting on my ATV or my dirt bike. Or like, you know, going out, we have like a little range set up, going out and like shooting at the steel plates and shooting cans and all that. You know what I mean? Like to shoot, you know what I mean? Target shoot, you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It's just so relaxing. I love doing all that stuff.
I love it.
So to me, when I get off, I just bought like a bike recently. So like when I get off tour, all I want to do is like ride the ATV, ride the bike and just go into the woods, go up and look at the mountains and just like stop with like a seltzer water. Take a seltzer water with lemon.
A little lemon.
These guys, I showed up, they had seltzer with lemon. I was like, God, you guys know exactly what, totally exactly what I was hoping for. And so
it was the rider. We got the rider before
but
you showed
now
up.
The rider. Now that it's winter, you know, it's about like, you know, I have a wood burning stove. It's about the wood burning stove. And
that's nice.
You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
It's really nice.
Sounds nice.
It's pretty cool.
Sign me up, man.
I love it.
Me and Benny are ready to move to the fucking woods. My wife won't do it, man. My wife loves it.
Where do you live?
I live in the Lower East Side.
We're ready.
She likes to be around people. And anytime we leave, it seems we run into fucking nut jobs. So,
there's nut jobs everywhere.
It's like, I grew up in Central Mass, and there's just fucking
everyone I deal with upstate jobs. Is totally cool. The only thing I'll say about upstate New York is you'll, like, call a plumber to come and fix stuff. And the guy will show up like a year later. Like, what do you mean? I'm here. I'm like, who are you? Get off my property. Get the hell out of here. They take like so long. They don't want to work or make money.
Better learn how to fix your own shit.
Trying to get a tree guy out to your house, man.
Supposedly there's a real good tree service up there. But you know how much it costs for a day? $1,700.
Whoa.
You get them out there for $1,700 and they'll cut and remove whatever you want. $1,700. It's a lot of money.
I'm gonna go up there and start a tree business, man.
But I have a tree that a part of its sections off over my barn, and it's not gonna fall. But one, it's getting bigger and bigger. So I'm like, I got to get a tree guy to trim this tree. So no, I don't want anything hanging over my barn. $1,700 though.
I know an old hardcore kid was in tree service. He'd probably be stoked to come work at the guy from Sick.
You gotta give me his number.
Do you guys remember?
I got a guy up there who's very fair. I found one.
Really? Guys in my band will, if they hear the Sick of It All guys, will crack jokes because they always say, like they always say to the Wisdom and Chains guys, oh, you went up to Craig's farm, he made you work and didn't pay you?
And Franklin used to tell me that. He's like, oh, I'm going upstate to do a floor at Armand's house or something.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
It's pretty random.
Yeah.
Do you guys remember that band tree?
He did Armand's whole bathroom.
Yeah, he did. He did work at his house, right? Yeah.
Wow. Did you do good work? Was it built to last?
Oh.
I was waiting. There it is.
I was waiting for it to come out.
Oh, Jonah. I knew you had something in the pocket.
That's good.
Wait,
that's good.
Jonah, don't you have a mystery friend in the pocket?
No, it ended up not working out.
If you don't, I do.
Whoa.
Yeah. You should do yours. I feel like mine's not good.
Mine's good, but a segment on here called Mystery Friend.
This is a mystery friend for who, me?
You. Yeah. So I'm going to say something that should make you think of this person and relate it, and then you have to guess who this person
is. This is revenge for the Roger questions, right?
Depending on how specific you are, he can elaborate on the story, right?
All right.
So it's a person you know who was injured. It's a person you know for a long time who was injured, and he said that he felt very lonely. But only one person reached out and said a sentiment that said, hardcore would never hurt one of its favorite sons. You said this to someone else. Do you remember who you said this to?
Yes, my good friend Jerry Waldron.
Yes, Jerry Waldron.
Love the man. Love the
mystery friend.
Nice. I have one too.
I mean, what a great thing to say to somebody.
I'm really good when I'm not in front of you. If I like write a text, I can really sound like I'm like, you know, coming across strong.
I felt like he just even told me that story, and I was inspired.
Yeah, because I wasn't in front of him. If I was in front of him, it wouldn't have worked.
All right, I do have one too, but I feel like
maybe
it's going to get.
You should write a book.
Well, I can write pretty well in school, like with writing and all that. Mm-hmm. I was always like really. The teachers were always like, "Wow, you write so well."
I'd read your book.
In first grade, I got a 12.9 on the like standardized like city tests. You know, you take those tests when you were a kid. I got 12.9 in first grade. 12.9 reading level and all that, writing, all that. So that was like my specialty.
Destined for a life in hardcore.
Oh my God. I had a request from one of your friends also. I feel like this is going to get edited out. I don't know what this is, but I have a feeling it's going to get edited out. They wanted you to talk about the Bronson wig.
Oh, you're talking about CPM. Colin Patrick McGinnis. Yeah, he's a friend of mine. He, you know, he plays in H2O now. He plays guitar.
Yeah,
he's a friend of mine from unfortunately, he's from Philadelphia, but he's still my friend.
Oh, man.
But we took him on tour as a roadie, and he he's like a big, rollicking, kind of loving guy, you know? And he would, like, sit around in his underwear in a hotel room. And, like, we'd always say, like, you know, it turned into he's sitting around in, like, a giant baby diaper. And he would just go nuts, like, laughing and going. The guy would go crazy. You couldn't sleep, but you'd have a great time with the guy. He was so funny. But if you look at his hair when he grows it long, it looks like Charles Bronson, the way he, like, combs to the side. So we'd call him Bronson Wig. We'd call him another one was Baby Elephant because he's so big, you know?
I thought this was going to be something, like, really dirty or something.
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all.
Oh, I see where your head went.
Yeah.
Oh, man. You're so creepy.
No. He was great. The guy could carry an SVT cabinet upstairs on his back by himself.
Oh, man.
An A-10?
He can't carry an
A-10
by himself.
That's a good guy to have on the road with him.
Pete has these cabinets that are all steel.
Oof.
They're in road cases. They're built into road cases. They're so heavy, he would carry them up no problem.
Jesus.
Super strong.
I wouldn't mess with the baby elephant.
Well, he's the happiest guy in the world, though. Yeah. He's the happiest guy in the world. Super happy guy. He's a great guy. His wife is the sweetest girl in the world. It's like twisted Americana because he's so crazy. But it's the perfect couple. You know
That's
what I mean?
Awesome. I was speaking to someone else you probably know, Chris Ross, Ensign and Nora and those bands. And we were talking the other day about how... A lot of our friends from the punk and hardcore scene, how the longer and longer they sort of get away from their old friends, get away from shows and get away from music, we're finding a lot of our old friends kind of a little conservative. You know what I mean? Like getting to a place that seems out of character for where we knew these people to be from. And Chris had said that he finds the longer and longer people are detaching, that they're like reverting to childhood roles where, like, you know, the longer and longer you're out of the scene, you basically just start becoming what you know and where you're from and something like that. Is that something you've had any experience with, like going through the scene like this?
I think so. Like Tommy from Straight Ahead, he stopped going to shows and being involved and he became an iron worker. And his whole view changed a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. He'll always be my friend and I love him, and he just seems to have had, you know, he became back to where he was when he was a kid pretty much, right, as far as like a neighborhood guy, you know. And whatever, nothing wrong with it, I'm just saying it that was a good example of that, you know what I mean? I also think that when you do this for so long and it's such an important thing to you, if you get out of it you become bitter and it passes you by. Mm-hmm. And maybe your bitterness comes off more like, hey, you know, blah, blah, blah. You become a little negative toward what's around you because you no longer have that connection or outlet.
You take the other side more of like a reactionary way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that. Sure. Yeah, it's interesting. It's something that I found so disappointing, but then also it makes me wonder, like, just the authenticity of so many people I knew in the scene, why they were doing things and like what their motivations were to actually be there. And, you know, were they racist the whole time and just like punk rock girls or you know, like it puts a big question mark.
I think it's bitterness, you know, more than anything. I think it's bitterness.
Yeah.
That's what it seems like to me. I don't know, man. I was hanging out with, before I came here, I stopped at Starbucks and I had like a tea cause I had some time to kill. And this Rasta dude walks in. And he's like, hey, man, you watch my phone. He plugged his phone in. He goes, hey, man. He looked at me. He looked around the room. And there was like a guy like nodding out. So I guess the guy was a junkie sitting there too, kind of close to me. And he looks at all these people and he looks at me. He makes eye contact with me. And he walks over and he goes, hey, man, you watch my phone. I got to run across the street. I was like, I got to leave. I got to leave in 2 minutes. And he's like, oh, I'll be 5 minutes. I go, I'll wait. Okay. But if you're 10 minutes, I got to leave. I said, you know, this guy was like, all right, cool. He goes there. And he comes back and he's like, oh, thank you, man. Thank you, man. So I look at him and I go, I forget what I said exactly. I go, listen, man, I hope you enjoy that bullshit holiday tomorrow. Cause he had a Lion of Judah ring and I look and I, you know, just to like throw it out there. Cause you know, he's going to bite right on that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And, we had a little bit of a talk for about 5 minutes about like Christmas and about, you know, consumerism and, you know, the bullshit we're all being fed. It was like a punk rock talk. And the dude was cool. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you connected.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, I don't know what my point was. We're talking about racism. So I'm thinking like, you know, how could you be a damn racist? People are cool. You just gotta let it fly, man.
Well, I mean, I can never understand someone who just lives in this city. You know, like you're inundated with the experience on such a daily level. You know, I can understand how someone in the middle of the country can get these skewed perspectives.
Right, because
it makes perfect sense. You know what I mean? Like psychologically, it would make perfect sense.
The television is what's making people racist.
Mm. Yeah.
It's the whole, you know, divide and conquer, pit the people against the people so they don't rise up and see what's going on, how we're being played by the system. We're being played, especially now more than ever. We're being played and everybody's asleep and people are like, what are you talking about? It's like, dude, this isn't good.
Talking about LeVar Ball and shit.
I don't want to say anything too specific, but this isn't good. You know, it kind of reminds me of some shit that happened in the 30s right before it got real bad.
Yeah.
It's like all this shit's being fed to you and it's like, yeah, it's okay. No, it's really not okay.
No.
It's really not okay.
Not okay.
It's not okay because this is going to turn into something real bad. But I think also that with the way media is, they're trying to put you in a mental prison. It's a psychological operation more than anything.
Sure.
They want to keep you in the box. They can't. They don't actually have enough manpower to keep you in the box. They want to keep you in the box mentally.
Right.
You know, have the dog be afraid of you know, the. It's almost like, better example, you put the owl in the tree where your dog plays outside.
Right.
And you don't have to worry about the birds of prey, the real owl coming to take your dog away.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah,
your little tiny dog or your cat.
Yeah.
It's almost like, put the idea out there and people will be scared. That's not a good example, but I couldn't think of it. This is what came to my head.
Like the owl.
You know what I mean, though?
Yeah,
put an owl in the tree and it's like the bats stay away or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a little confused right now, but you get the idea.
No, I definitely get the idea.
So what else do you have kind of going on, like, as far as, like, are you touring soon?
Well, actually, we've been on the road for about the last 2.5 years, pretty much nonstop. You get a week off, 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah, I was saying, I just was in Singapore, and there was a Sick of It All flyer that just missed you guys.
Yeah, he just missed us by
a week in Singapore. I would have gone, for sure.
Wow, and, that would have been awesome.
So we've been on tour. We had, like, you know, occasionally we get 3 weeks off. We even had a month off once or twice in the last 2.5 years, but it's not long. It's like you get a week off, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. So now we have 4 months off. 4 months, and I have 2 Mags gigs in that time, Brooklyn and Philly, which are going to be fun because playing in Philly is always great, and Brooklyn is going to be good. So I got 4 months off, so I'm just going to chill. But it's the middle of the winter. I'd rather have summertime off, but you never have summertime off, you know? And then the next thing we don't have anything booked. We're going to work on a new album, but we have like 2 weeks with Municipal Waste from Texas through Florida and up the East Coast. So that's not even really like work. That's like absolute fun. Those guys are like the greatest dudes ever. So it's going to be absolute fun.
You take 4 months off. Do you have to practice or no?
No.
It's like muscle memory.
Don't have to practice ever.
Yeah.
What has to happen is Armand has to practice his drums in his basement just to get his body used to the maneuvering. I think Lou has to go to the studio by his house and sing along to like a CD of Sick of It All songs. Yeah, he'll sing along to like the thing we did a couple years ago. All the old songs redone. He'll like sing along to that. You know, he'll have it loud in the room and he'll sing in the PA.
So
where
it's just
voice
physically
goes,
getting.
It's just
ready.
Physically getting ready. Yeah. You know, gotcha. I don't have to do anything. With the first two shows, my thumb muscle will get like the size of a baseball. Look at the size of my thumb muscle. See that?
Yeah.
I have a freakishly, from playing bass my entire life, I have like a bodybuilder's thumb muscle. It looks like I have a handball sticking out of it. Isn't that crazy?
It looks like an injury, crazy. Man.
Yeah, it looks like a handball sticking out of my hand. That's just absolutely crazy. And when I play a show when I haven't played in a while, I'll get lactic acid buildup in there and it'll get like twice as big. Wow. Called the frog.
You're called Guinness?
What?
call Guinness biggest thumb muscle in America?
I probably could. It's really freaky, isn't it?
It's big.
That is like a new definition of hardcore.
That looks abnormal, right?
Yeah.
That's Brad, impressive. Can we maybe make this the cover image for the podcast?
Sure.
Just the actual thumb muscle?
Thumb muscle.
That's a pretty good name for a funny hardcore band. Thumb muscle?
That is a good idea.
We had stupid names. Pete, we come up with good ones. He came up with like Steroid Cop.
Yeah. That's a good name.
Hand over fist.
Steroid Cop.
Would you join my overweight hardcore band called Girth Crisis?
You know something? I think you robbed that from us because we used to always say that too. I used to say to Armand, like, you know, you should join Girth Crisis.
So I do have a funny story.
That's crazy. That's the same.
Trying
one.
To play up to you guys once. And
I am a little chubby though.
I don't know if you were there right now.
So yeah, I do need to lose some weight. Thanks for pointing it out over the air.
He's rubbing his belly with a Santa Claus.
I lost 5 pounds in 10 days.
Nice.
But I did the most illegal thing maybe in my life, trying to look cool in front of Sick of It All. This actually happened. I got taken by Tim Shaw and Jerry, who we already mentioned. Sick of It All was doing an interview on WSOU, Pirate Radio Scene Hall. I think it might have been the Metal Mayhem show or one of the Hardcore Reality. There was those couple shows.
What year?
It would have been 96, 97, somewhere around there. And those guys were like, do you want to go hang out with Sick of It All? I'm like, yes. And I was very giddy and excited.
It's weird.
And, you know, listen, you guys did the segment. I thought I was being cool. And we were walking out of there. And I jumped into, like, a locker room. On campus at Seton Hall, and I took a practice basketball jersey from the locker room and left with it. And I did this to try to be cool for you guys.
And it's probably the most thing how stealing something being cool.
I don't fucking know. I was like 16.
Did you let us know that you stole it?
Yeah, I think I just was like, check it out. Like, I probably tried to play it off a little bit.
Why is this guy stealing shit?
Yeah, they're probably like,
this guy's an asshole.
We're never going to get back in this room.
Don't bring this thing around again. What are you doing, Tim?
Don't bring him around.
It's distorted. But it happened. And I did. I wore it for a while. Not out, because, you know, guy like me can't wear basketball jerseys around. Well, actually, probably nobody should, I guess. But I don't know.
Worked in the 90s.
I have mixed feelings about this.
You know who brought the bat? Don't worry about it.
I mean, can you give me some kind of,
I've done out of character things randomly that just happened.
Can you give me some kind of repentance? I need some repentance. I need to feel better about this. It's nagging me still.
Seltzer with lemon, lots of it.
All right. Thank you to Craig for coming by.
Thank you very much. I've been in the room with Craig many times, obviously, and I may not have ever even been introduced to him. But yeah, I've been around those guys for years. He's just one of those guys that, like, you think you know him. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I know like three dudes that are just like him. And like, so it's very easy to kind of like just interact.
You feel very
right
comfortable around him immediately.
I do feel comfortable. Yeah. I also just kind of know who he is. Yeah.
I agree. And also, I think we should try to get ourselves invited to his place upstate.
Yeah.
That was like what I was thinking the whole podcast. I was like, all right, I'm going to get myself invited here.
You want to go ride some ATVs?
I want to so bad. I mean, I feel like I'll be on it for like 5 seconds before I like break something. But I still want to be like, me and Craig were just riding ATVs last weekend. Like, what were you doing? Like, you know.
You could probably get some Instagram mileage out of that.
Oh, for sure.
Visit, couldn't you?
For sure. I just hope my ATV wouldn't break down with all those breakdowns. In their music. But yeah, Sick of It All, obviously I don't need to hype them. They've been around for 30 years, legendary hardcore band, one of the best. Check them out. Check out Straight Ahead, all of Craig's older bands. everything Craig's done. I mean, that dude is just very humble, very funny, and just a super, super talented guy. So thank you so much for coming by. Thank you again to Pulse Music and Steve Rywalski for making us sound so good. If you want to book a session there, that would make us look really good. So do it.
Yeah, I would. Be sure to mention us if you do.
Yes, definitely mention us. Mention your favorite podcast is recorded there, and you just wanted to capture some of that magic. And if you want to support this podcast, you can go to patreon.com/goingofftrack. There's a bunch of different levels.
Just had two people today sign up for $1
really?
A month. Yeah.
Yeah. And every little bit helps, man.
Yeah. It's fantastic. And you know, it definitely shows that you're a supporter. And I would never even think to belittle that contribution because it's fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, the podcast is free, obviously. Yes. And it'll stay free. But if it's going to stay ad free, we do need these contributions. And so far, everybody's been really good. There's a bunch of different levels that you can get involved at, and they all have different things that you can reap from just out of pure love to. Who knows what?
Who knows what?
I think we've got a couple of big contributors that we're really going to have to think of some good things to come up
with.
We'll
come up with some good stuff.
We have to personally go to their house and cook them dinner.
But also, if you want to book an ad, you can always email me. If you're cool. Only stuff that we're actually into.
Right. Or you can just give us free beer.
Free beer. We're looking for a beer sponsor. I got a couple leads on that.
Okay, let's do it.
So
we can definitely make some exposure.
I guess I got a hops to it. if you're not into the recurring thing, that's cool. You can also do a one-time donation over at Venmo/offtrack. You can donate via PayPal. All this stuff is also
it's all on our website.
On our website, goingofftrack.com. And you can also, if money's tight, we get it. Just leave us a review on iTunes. That always helps. Or just spread the word, tweet at us. Just let us know you're listening. If you see us out and around, give us a handshake. Maybe a
high five.
A high five. I like the hitting the rock kind of.
Okay.
That's fun. So yeah. But yeah, we appreciate everyone's support, from nothing to a dollar to people that are pledging a lot every month. It all helps us pay our server costs and offset. This podcast is a lot of work. It's a labor of love, and we really appreciate it, and we're going to keep doing it. And thanks again to Craig for coming by, and we'll be back with another podcast next week. So thanks. Talk to you then. Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.